everyone, and welcome to episode 25 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sabalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. For the last couple of weeks, I've been enjoying sharing some of my favorite things about the Middle Ages with you, from myth-busting to my favorite books. So, I've decided to do it one more time. This week, Peter Konieczny from Medievalist.net and I are going to share with you three of our favorite stories from the Middle Ages. Two of them are true stories about real people, and one is a fictional one. Two truths and a lie, it turns out. I'm hoping, as I always do, that hearing just a little bit about these great stories and people will whet your appetite for more medieval goodness, because there are so many amazing stories, both fictional and true, for us to discover. Without further ado, then, here are three of Peter's and my favorite medieval tales. So Peter and I are going to talk about some of our favorite stories from the Middle Ages, and we've decided that I'm going to go first, right?
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to go first. And I'm going to talk about a real story, and it's the story of my favorite queen, who is, I have a lot of favorite queens, but she might be my favorite, and that's Isabella of France, who was the wife of Edward II of England. And I just think that she has so much in the way of intelligence and guts and stuff. I just really think she was a great queen and a great story. So we'll start with Isabella. You can find her story in Helen Castor's She-Wolves, which we had as part of the podcast a couple weeks ago. Or you can find her complete biography by Alison Weir if you want to look into these later.
Ready to listen. I hear about her life and legacy, so.
Okay, so Isabella was the daughter of Philip the Fair, who is all sorts of crazy for his own reasons. And she was betrothed to Edward II as a child. And she married him when she was about 12, and he was just about 24. Edward II he's the prince that you see in Braveheart. And Isabella is played by Sophie Marceau in Braveheart. But at the time of Braveheart, she's just a kid. So there's no like William Wallace stuff. Just gotta get that out of the way.
So William Wallace is not the father of Edward III?
William Wallace is not the father of Edward III. Sorry, everybody.
I made all these mistakes. Ah. Okay, go ahead.
So Peter needs to edit some stuff on medievalist.net. No, just kidding. So Isabella was as devoted a queen as she could be for the longest time as Edward II. He went through favorites, and his first favorite that was really a troublemaker was a guy called Piers Gaveston. And he and Edward II were so close that people think they were probably lovers. It's very possible. We don't have, you know, evidence for sure, but it's very possible that they were lovers. And so Edward kept giving Piers all sorts of titles and land and power and all sorts of things. And it made everybody else in the kingdom very, very upset, because Piers was not a nice guy. He was very arrogant, and he used to poke fun at all the different earls, and he gave them really nasty nicknames and stuff. And so he was just the enemy of everybody.
Everyone's just jealous, right? You know, you get to become the king's favorite, and then all of a sudden, everyone else who's not the king's favorite is like, ah. So.
Well, there's a certain amount of, you know, sort of professional jealousy, but also the fact that Edward didn't actually do very much as a king when Piers was around. He wasn't fighting the Scots. He wasn't helping the people. He wasn't paying much attention to his kingdom at all, and definitely not to his wife. So eventually the earls and the barons got together. They captured Piers and beheaded him. And this made Edward very upset, but he was able to concentrate on kingship for a little while and revenge. And in the meantime, Isabella had a bunch of children, and she really supported him and helped him out and gave him good advice. And then Edward found another favorite, who was Hugh de Spencer the Younger. And he started doing the same things again. He started giving Hugh de Spencer all sorts of titles and land. And Hugh was very power hungry. He was different from Piers Gaveston in that he was more power hungry than arrogant, but at the same time he was taking all of Edward's attention away from the realm, and people were starving, and It was very bad times. And so Isabella was like, you know what? I've been dealing with this for like 15 years or so. I've had enough. The kingdom is awful. I'm a queen and I can do a lot better at this than he can. So she conveniently goes over as his emissary to France and stays with her brother, who's the king of France. And while she's there, she says, you know, marriage is supposed to be between a man and a woman, but there's somebody in my marriage bed. And until he goes, I'm going to be a widow. And so she refuses to go back to England.
Oh, wow. She's laying it down on the line there, right? Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. She put it all out there. And she's pretty safe in the arms of her brother, right? You know, France is very powerful. And Edward, he can't do anything about it, because if he leaves, then Hugh Dispenser is going to be totally mobbed by all the people who hate him. So he doesn't know what to do. So he sends his son, Edward, over. And now Isabella has everything. She has the alliance of France. She has the prince, the heir to the throne there. And she has all the support of the European kingdoms. And then she manages to get an army by betrothing her son Edward to Philip of Hainault. So she's got an army, she's got all the backing of Europe, and she goes across the channel with her lover. She's got a lover too, Roger Mortimer, who's a very powerful marcher lord. And she brings her army over to England, and everyone's like kind of happy to see her, because they're like, oh, you know, give us some relief from this Dispenser guy. So instead of there being a civil war or anything, even though Isabella has betrayed her husband, betrayed her king, she's in an adulterous affair, everybody's like, oh, thank God somebody's here that's competent, that's going to take care of business. And sure enough, Isabella captures Edward, she imprisons him, and she puts her son on the throne. And everybody's kind of okay with this. So her son becomes Edward III. And Edward II is imprisoned. Like I said, he's probably not murdered by having a hot poker shoved up his nethers. That's probably not what happened. But regardless, Edward II eventually dies, and Edward III is king.
Well, there is a story, and I don't think I believe it too much, but there is a story that Edward II somehow lives. He escapes, and then he's kind of like in hiding, while doesn't kind of emerge for like another 10, 15 years, and then like he meets up with his son. But that's been a story that's kind of gone around. Some historians believe it, but most don't.
Yeah, I'm going to call BS on that. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, stranger things have happened, but I'm going to say that Edward did die in prison, and also aliens did not build the pyramids. I'm going to take a stand on these things, Peter. I'm sorry.
There's all sorts of things I have to correct on the website.
It's the pyramids thing, isn't it? Right. So then Edward III is on the throne. And behind him, because he's just a young man at this time, he's not very experienced. And so behind him is Isabella, who's teaching him how to rule, basically. He's got advisors around him, but she's still with Roger Mortimer. And Edward III increasingly does not like that. But so he orchestrates a plan in which he captures Mortimer himself. And, Mortimer, he's executed as a traitor because you need to get rid of them. But Edward is always listening to the advice of his mother. He, you know, puts her aside because he cannot, you know, execute Mortimer and then have his mom still be preeminent in the court because they were both causing trouble. But he does listen to his mother for the rest of her life because she is a very, very smart woman. And the fact that she could stage a coup so elegantly and with such minimal bloodshed, I think really, really speaks to her ability to understand her role as a queen and her ability to understand politics. And so I think she's my favorite queen. She's really super interesting.
You have to even keep in mind that this is a French queen that takes over the English throne, really, which is just kind of goes to show her really abilities, right? Like, if you can convince the English nobility not only that, oh, I'm going to take over, but I'm also going to take, I'm a French person taking over the English crown, which would have ruffled some feathers, I would think. But yeah, she certainly was very bright.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the thing was that even though she had showed herself to be like extremely intelligent and helpful to help Edward rule earlier, he and Hugh Despenser totally underestimated her. So like Hugh Despenser kind of pushed Edward to get rid of all the French people in court because, you know, they were up against the French at this time, and to really limit her powers. And they thought, you know, she's still going to be obedient enough that if we send her over as an envoy, she'll still come back because, you know, she's always been such a great wife. But they totally underestimated the fact that, you know, she was going to take power into her own hands because she understood it. She knew how it worked and she could see the writing on the wall. So her Frenchness could have worked against her, as you say, but her competence really overruled that. Like you say, the fact that she's French, that she was an adulteress, that she was disloyal to her king. Like, all of these things should have weighed against her, but the fact that she was so cunning made it work. I don't want to say cunning because that sounds like devious, but she was really, well, intelligent.
I think she's like probably one of the first of these kind of line of 14th and 15th century kind of French queens that really take matters in their own hands. Several like kind of really run the French throne for a while. And even other kings, like English kings, are being have these French wives that actually play a huge part in their reigns. So yeah, so it's kind of a tradition that starts with her.
Well, yeah, during the Hundred Years' War, like, you watch out for French women because there are so many dudes that are off at war, you know, throughout the Hundred Years' War, but also at other times during the Middle Ages. And while they're gone, their wives are in charge and they are so competent and so aware of how things are meant to be run, what their responsibilities are, and that kind of thing. Like, if you look at women and their power when the men are away, the Middle Ages is kind of a great time for women. David Green was talking about that a little bit when we talked about the Hundred Years' War on the podcast really early on. But they really were able to rule their own lands in a way that is very admirable and wasn't really available to other women in other times in history. So,
great story.
I'm ready to hear your story, Peter. So you have a story that is a true story as well, right? Yeah, from the Middle Ages?
And it's actually around the exact same time as yours, because this happens in 1327. So about 15 years ago, I kind of started looking into like London, the city of London, and I found that there was all these great like civic records that kind of start in late 13th century, just keep going on. Basically, the mayors and the courts, they all kept their records, and we still have them. We can still access them. And what you get in these kind of like city records is just a lot of this daily life of people interacting with the city council, with, you know, causing trouble. Like, you get the stuff like, oh, my neighbor is building a wall too high. Yeah, things like that. It's like fun stuff. So what I really liked about was all these kind of little stories of frauds and con men. And there's all sorts of, they come, you know, here and there. Like, there's a story of the guy that's impersonating the wine tax collector. And he's like, oh, I gotta drink this wine and make sure it's okay. And so we have that. You've got, you know, all the trades have, you know, people trying to kind of skim off things, and you know, like, oh, if you're the metal worker, like, you find, oh, this metal is cheap and like it's not up to standard and things like that. And the most infamous group for that are the bakers of London. The one thing you have to know is, like, bakers, if you bake bread, you had to, every year you'd have to make the bread like a certain way. It was called like the size of bread. And it was because you had to sell a loaf for like one penny. So to make it profitable, they would just change how heavy the loaf was or the size and that. And they would test the bakers out, and if your loaf was too small, you'd get in trouble. So they would kind of like do little tricks to make their loaves a little heavier, like mix it in with dirt.
Oh man, that's gross.
Or put a little iron rod into the bread. You know, like, things like that, right? So you're always causing trouble. Like that's there. You always see the, you know, those bakers, you know. And it's this one account. It comes in the year 1327. It starts off like that. You have the mayor and six aldermen and a sheriff. Like they're having this kind of court meeting, and they bring this guy named John Brid up, and they say like, oh, one of the sheriffs has caught him stealing dough. Literally stealing dough. So the story goes, and they explain it here, is that in the baker's house, he has a molding board where they would like take flour, make bread, right? And a lot of people would come and use the bakery to make their own bread. And so people would come in, you know, getting all the ingredients, making the bread there. On this molding board is a little mouse trap, a little thing like on it that would a mouse would walk over and he would fall through. So like almost like a little hole. Now, what the sheriff has said, and they said, is that John has secretly put a servant underneath this table, and they were reaching up through this little hole and grabbing bits of flour and bits of the bread as people were working on it. And I'm just trying to imagine like this guy in like a little box underneath the table, like reaching up, grabbing little bits of bread, little bits of dough. So,
okay, so as you're saying, like people would bring their bread to the bakery to get it baked for them because they wouldn't have an oven at home. So the servant is stealing dough from other people's bread to be used for the bakery?
Exactly, exactly. And apparently they're keeping this dough underneath the table. Like they're so that's how the person gets caught, right? Like they literally find the dough, a little pile of dough underneath the guy's, you know, molding board. And they arrest him. And so right away, like the guy says, no, I didn't do it. Like, and the mayor and sheriff said, well, we need to investigate this a bit more. So a couple days go by, and then a whole bunch of other people get arrested for the same thing. Another seven bakers and two bakeresses get arrested and they're thrown into the Newgate jail. So things are starting to happen here. So everyone denies it, right? But apparently there's the proof, right? They actually have all these people doing the same little trick to steal the dough from underneath those poor customers. So a week goes by. Then they have another court meeting, and you know things are getting serious when you have now you have the mayor, you have 17 aldermen, two sheriffs, and they have representatives of every ward of London come, between six and a dozen men for each ward. So you must have like literally 150, 200 men kind of there just to, you know, like rain down on judgment on these people, right? The court record, like they found them all guilty. Like they're like, all of you, you've done it. Like, and I love how they kind of like tell these people, like, you know, what a horrible thing they've done. Like, you've been falsely and wickedly and maliciously deceiving the common people.
That is pretty malicious.
It is. It's terrible. You could almost see like everyone in London, like, we're gonna get those bakers. Everyone eats bread, right? Everyone like, and so all the men go to the pillory, right? Which is like the traditional punishment. It's at this time, it's right at St. Paul's Cathedral. So it's right, like, this is like the humiliation punishment, right? Of being, you know, affixed to the pillory all day. And the ones where they were actually get the dough, they actually put the dough around their, like on chains around their necks.
It's like... like a pretzel around their necks.
You could just see this dough, and I'm sure it stank after, like, you know, all day. You know, like, you know, this is a nice summer day, so like, ah, oh, just, and they put them all there, and basically said like, or and then they also took all their molding boards and smashed them up. So
oh wow.
So but yeah, I think the Bakers got off, you know, relatively lightly. Like, yeah, a week in jail, you know, a little punishment, because he said the next time you do it, you get the same punishment, then we kick you out of the city. So at least they got to stay in the city. But that was that I think is like the best tale of like medieval life that I have ever come across. You got your, you know, guys just doing that little bit of fraud to, you know, just make ends meet, like taking little bits of bread, you know, little bits of dough, just to, you know, just skimming the system, literally skimming the system. So you have that, and then you've got like the machinery of government kind of kicking in with, you know, a little kind of court, you know, scene, and then it just kind of blows up after a week. So living in medieval London. So that's, you know, maybe that's why they didn't care about who was ruling them, because they were too busy thinking about bakers.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. So 1327 is the year that, you know, Isabella comes across and Edward III is put on the throne. And it's good to know that life is going on in London in the middle of this. People are stealing dough to make more bread and to make more money. So it's a good story. I like it.
Yeah, I love little tales of fraud and, you know, people just, you know, trying to screw out their neighbors with, you know, doing this or doing that. Like, you always hear about the, like, you know, the rulers and the kings, and I kind of like the kind of, you know, tales of the commoners just going about their lives. So
oh yeah, like the court stories, like where you have the prostitutes that are yelling at each other saying, you know, she called me this name, and then they're having like slander cases and stuff, like this bread one. Yeah, having like the ingenious nature of like how to steal bread through a mouse trap. I think that's brilliant. It's a good story.
Thanks. Yeah, it's my little fun little story. Something to tell at, you know, dinner parties. So
oh, do you tell that a lot at dinner parties?
I should, shouldn't I?
You should go to more dinner parties just so you can tell that story. The other one that I was going to tell is a fictional story, and that is just a brief recap. I think a lot of people have heard of the story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and I won't spoil the ending for you, but I'll tell you a little bit about that one. Peter, did you ever read that poem yourself?
I read it like in undergraduate, so it's been a long time. So I know a few of the details, and I always love the kind of imagery that we have in that one manuscript of it, you know, with a guy with the head come off. So
yeah, I think it only exists in one manuscript, and I will admit that I saw it when I was in England last year, and I did get all teary because it's such a cool looking manuscript. You often see facsimiles of it in black and white, but it is in color, and it's really, really grubby, because back in the day people really liked this story as well, and I still really like it. So Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. I thought I would talk about this one because Peter has just brought back my article that I wrote on how Gawain kicks Sir Lancelot's ass. So you can see that. It's not all from this one poem. But Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. What basically happens is the Knights of the Round Table and King Arthur, they're sitting down for their New Year's feast, and this Green Knight comes in, and he's huge, and he's got this big axe, and he proposes a competition. And, you know, usually in these Arthurian stories, King Arthur says, like, we can't eat until I've seen something miraculous. So I think people save up their miracles just so, like, they can eat, right? Because you can't actually eat at Arthur's court until something miraculous happens. So this giant Green Knight shows up. He proposes a competition where somebody gets to chop off his head, and then a year later, he will get to chop off their head. And so everyone kind of looks around at each other like, should we do it? Is it a trick? And Gawain, who is the bravest, best knight, steps up and says, I will do this. So he does. Everyone thinks that, you know, this is going to be easy, right? He'll just cut off the guy's head and he's dead. He can't possibly repay this blow. But Gawain takes up the Green Knight's axe, cuts off his head, and sure enough, the Green Knight picks up his own head and rides away saying, like, see you later, see you next year. And he leaves. And so everyone's like, well, that was strange. And now what are you going to do, Gawain? But sure enough, a year passes and he goes looking for where he should find the Green Knight. He doesn't know where he should find them. But he comes across this castle and there's a lord and lady in the castle. And they're like, oh, we know who you're talking about. He's at the Green Chapel. It's not very far away. So you can just stay with us until it's time for you to meet up with him and get your head cut off. So Gawain says, okay, cool. And the lord says, all right, so we're going to have this really great time where I'm going to go out and I'm going to hunt for great things for you to eat. And you're going to stay home in the castle and be spoiled. But whatever you get at the castle, you give to me as I'll give you the stuff that I've hunted for. And Gawain says, oh, sure, this sounds like a great idea. Except what happens is the first day, the lady comes to Gawain while he's still in bed. So medieval people didn't wear a lot of clothes when they went to bed. And the lady comes to him while he's still in bed and starts giving him kisses. So then that is what Gawain gets during the day. So when the lord comes back and he's like, what did you get today, Gawain? He gives him a kiss. And this happens again on the second day. And then the lady comes back and she says, well, I don't want you to die, you know, tomorrow when you go and meet the Green Knight. So I'll give you this sash. It's a magical sash and you can wear it. And if you wear it, then the Green Knight can't cut off your head. So sure enough, the lord comes back and says, Gawain, what did you get today? I got this cool stuff from my hunting. What did you get? You have to give whatever you got to me. And Gawain doesn't. He doesn't give the sash. But Gawain is the most honorable of all of Arthur's knights. And he's stuck between a rock and a hard place because he's promised to give these things. But he also doesn't want to die. So he's stuck in this really difficult position. So I won't spoil the ending. You find out what happens if you read the book. If you're not good at reading Middle English, Tolkien has done a translation, which is really quite good. You can check out. But yeah, what I really love about this, first of all, the language is just gorgeous. And Gawain's got a really cool horse and he's got great armor and it's all just described so beautifully. And he's so heroic. But I think when you look at stories from the Middle Ages, it's easy to see the characters as very two-dimensional. They go and they're the best knight and they fight and, you know, they win. But here it is, like Gawain is faced with this huge dilemma as to what he should do. Should he save his own life? Or should he strictly follow the rules of chivalry? Like what should he do? And it's a very complex sort of plot when it comes to what a knight should be doing about his chivalrous vows. And it gets at the kind of thing that real knights were dealing with, and that they were making vows here and vows there, and what did it mean in certain circumstances, and what were you meant to do in other circumstances. So I really like this poem because it's very complicated, but you still get, you know, this heroic Gawain who I've always loved. So much more complicated than Lancelot, right? And I'd like to see this story, how he deals with conflicting loyalties and self-preservation. So
one thing I really like his character. It's also he's the nephew of King Arthur, so at the start I think he's also like, oh, I don't know if I deserve to be here amongst all you other great knights of the Round Table. I'm just here because I'm the nephew. And you know, so he's got a bit of that. Like, this is a guy with like a lot of like real emotions and conflicts and stuff like that. So he's really fleshed out as a character.
Yeah. He has, like you say, he has a lot of different thoughts and emotions, and you see them in a way that sometimes you don't in other legends and Arthurian legends, stuff like that. And this is the poem to read. I mean, Malory is not very nice to Gawain, and T.H. White is much worse. But this is the poem that really kind of solidified my love for Gawain. I really like this one.
Like, do you think it's a very different kind of Arthurian tale from like kind of the rest? Is it really set on its own?
Yeah, this one is very, very different because of that complexity. Because many of them are formulaic in that there is kind of the knight goes on a quest and he has to deal with things in this way, and he does, and it's great, and he wins, usually. I mean, Lancelot's story is complicated in that he's got this love for Guinevere, which is absolutely forbidden, but he doesn't. In some ways, he never seems as agonized about this as Gawain does. Not until afterwards, when Camelot has fallen apart. And then he seems to be, you know, agonized. He goes mad for a while. But you don't usually see the complexity of, like, of Lancelot's conflicting loyalties as much as you do in this poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And the crazy thing is about this poem is we don't know who wrote it, and we don't know necessarily when it was written. It's still kind of mysterious.
And you only have one manuscript, so it's not like a tale that was super popular. Like, it may have been just like at one spot, and this is, you know, one guy's kind of literary creation, right? So
yeah, it may not have had kind of much opportunity to be spread. The language of it is not Southern England, it's Northern, well, it's further north in England. If you look at the language and how things are spelled and stuff, so it's not written in a place that would have, you know, a huge amount of dissemination. So again, like, you know, I'm seeing on Twitter people are talking about like how rare it is, how someone was saying, I've forgotten who said it, you know, the Book of Marjorie Kemp exists in one manuscript as well. And so a lot of these really famous poems and works, they only exist in one manuscript. And sometimes it's because they're not very popular because people read them and maybe didn't like them. But sometimes they just never had an opportunity to be spread. And so it's kind of random fate. But I'm really glad this one survived.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we often come across, like, where, like, works and they say, like, this was really popular. It survives in three manuscripts in full, right? And then there's others where it's, oh, they have about 10 lines of it or something like that. So even, like, kind of great works, like, even Beowulf is only in one manuscript, right? So it's often luck that, you know, these things kind of survive to us to present day, and we get like these kind of great little tales.
Something like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales could spread more easily because, like I said, of the location, but something like this maybe didn't. And we don't know how far it spread orally. Like you say, like it might exist in three manuscripts or 10 or whatever, but something like this, you don't know how it spread orally. And something I think I mentioned in the article about Gawain being the best is that he existed in oral tales before he existed in manuscripts, as far as we can tell, whereas Lancelot was a creation of the written word. Christian de Troyes wrote Lancelot or the Knight of the Cart, and that was his first appearance. And so something like the Gawain story, who knows if this was a story before it was a poem. My guess, and this is based on really nothing but gut instinct, my guess is that this was written, not an oral tale first. But, you know, who knows if it was picked up as an oral tale later. Just don't know. It's a mysterious time, which is what makes it so great. And having records like we have of the dose dealers is just unimaginable luck, and also just what makes it so much fun to look into this stuff.
Yeah, like, you know, I think we're in kind of this kind of position that we can read all these kind of works that are coming in, that are being published, like authors or historians are kind of combing through archives and finding great little sources or taking a look in like at manuscripts and saying, hey, look what I found. This exists. So we're really lucky that, you know, we still have all these kind of works to kind of consume and like find out new great tales about the Middle Ages.
Yeah, there's always more to learn. And that's kind of what makes it so great, is you feel like you never have learned everything. And that is kind of what's interesting. I'm talking about Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which is one of the most famous poems now to be studied of the Middle Ages. But there are so many more obscure ones that need to be pulled out and brought to the forefront because they are so awesome. And speaking of stuff that needs to be pulled out to the forefront, what's new on the website this week, Peter?
Good transition, Danielle.
I worked hard on that for about One second.
We have a piece, actually, it's the 10th anniversary of the discovery of the Staffordshire Horde.
Really? That's fascinating.
Yeah, this is this Anglo-Saxon horde that's found in northern England. Metal detector kind of walking along a farm, you know, picks it up. And it's this kind of collection of like hundreds, maybe even a couple thousand pieces of different gold and silver items. It became quite the kind of news story. And I remember that it was actually when it was right around this time we started medievalist.net that this was like our first big news story that we kind of ever covered. It was the 10th anniversary, so we have a piece on that. And another kind of discovery that just happened is like two more Viking ships, their boat burials kind of discovered in Sweden. So we still have a little news on the site this week. So
awesome. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
If you love the podcast, get involved by becoming one of our patrons on Patreon. You can sign up to donate less than the price of a cup of coffee per month, or you can grab yourself a sweet subscription to Medieval Warfare Magazine and help us out at the same time. Every single bit is appreciated. You can find us at patreon.com/medievalists. To read about the 10th anniversary of the Staffordshire Horde, and to find out how Gawain kicks Lancelot's ass, as well as loads of other great articles about the Middle Ages, you can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can also follow me, Danielle Cebulski, across social media at 5minmedievalist, or you can check out my books, including pre-ordering my new one, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for allowing me to share some of my favorite things with you. Have yourself an awesome day.